Ark Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure game where most of humanity shelters underground. But raiders rise to the surface in search of something greater. In the Rust Belt, danger isn't the end of the story. It's the beginning of the adventure. Every journey above ground is a gamble against the relentless machines of Ark and rival raiders chasing the same dream. Explore a lethal yet vibrant world scarred by old conflicts and reclaimed by nature, where shifting conditions make every high-stakes run unpredictable. Ark Raiders. Available now on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X, S, and PC. Rated T for Teen.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You're tuned into Auto Intelligence, live from Auto Trader, where data, tools, and your preferences sync to make your car shopping smooth.
They're searching inventory.
Oh, yeah.
They find what you need.
They're going to find
it. You can make a budget for your wallet to help you succeed.
Mm.
Pricing's precise and true.
So true.
It's smarter car shopping.
Ooh.
Just for you.
Oh, it's just for you.
Ooh.
Find your next ride at autotrader.com. Powered by Auto Intelligence.
When was the last time you thanked God for your healthcare? At Redeem Healthshare Ministry, it's not just about paying medical bills. It's about honoring Christ and relieving the burden of rising medical costs. From routine checkups to life surprises, Redeem offers affordable, flexible programs supported by a caring Christian community. Say amen to healthcare that fits your faith and your budget. See how it works at redeemhealthshare.org.
A tad discombobulated, but we'll get it together. 504-260-1870. Now that the government's back in operation, if there's something you'd like to see the government do less of, I'll compile the results and let you know what the top five are around 9 o'clock or so. Right now, we're joined by Todd Bell, professor and director of the Political Management Program at George Washington University. How you doing, professor?
Martin, Tommy, doing well. It's great to be back with you. How are you this morning?
Fine, sir. Thank you. Tell me about the government shutdown, first of all. Who wins from this? Who loses from this politically in terms of perception, if anybody?
Well, America's getting back to work, and that's certainly a good thing after 43 days of this. The big winners, of course, are the federal workers, the federal contractors, and the people who've been working without pay. Our air traffic controllers and all those people are certainly the big winners. But if we want to talk about this a bit more politically, it looks like the Republicans came out on top on this one, that the Democrats did not get what they want. They got a few minor concessions in the bill that was passed by the House last night, including that up or down vote on those Affordable Care Act extension, premium enhancement extensions. So those subsidies that you and I talked about last time. It's probably going to be a 1 year, although we're sometimes hearing now maybe a 2 year extension that they'll be debating. And I think the Democrats think they have some leverage on that, because if the Republicans vote against it, then in an election year, a lot of people are going to face those really high premiums you and I were talking about running up to the next election. So that could be damaging for the Republicans. That vote is probably going to be scheduled mid-December. And you might think, you know, the Democrats are getting ready to start writing some commercials like the Grinch that stole your healthcare or something like that.
Let's talk about redistricting and what's going on there. And have we seen all of the states redistrict? Tell for people that don't quite understand, Professor, what's been going on in Texas, what's going on in California, other states positioning for the midterms, and how odd it is that that should happen in the middle of censuses.
Right. It is odd. Usually we have the redistricting that is the redrawing of the lines for Congress because they're capped at 435 members. And people move around, and some places grow faster than others. Some places actually shrink in terms of population. So every 10 years, we redraw those lines so there's roughly an equal proportion of people in each of the districts that is represented by each of the members. It's about 900,000 in each district. And that it usually happens the year after the census. So, you know, usually whoever wins their state legislature in like the 2010 or 2020 elections is going to have that power. That power is given to the state legislatures under the Constitution. However, some states can change that. The legislature can give away its power, as California did when they said, the state legislature said, we want to put together a nonpartisan commission to draw our districts. And there are other states that get put together commissions. Sometimes they're populated by judges or members of the executive branch. Where you have a state like Texas, it's fully done by the state legislature. And Donald Trump is concerned about next year because traditionally the president's party will lose seats in the upcoming election. Of course, he doesn't want to lose control of Congress. And the margins are very close. Three seats in the Senate and two to three, depending on what the piece of legislation is in the House right now. And that's why he asked the first domino to fall was Texas. And he asked Texas to redraw their map so they could try to eke out another five seats. And whenever there's an action, there's a reaction in politics. And we saw California get into the mix saying they were going to try to draw five seats. But the thing about California is the legislature had given that power away through the referendum process, meaning that the voters had voted on these nonpartisan districts. And so they had to go back to the people to override that decision. That's what happened just last week in California, that Proposition 50 passed. And now we're seeing some of the other states doing this. But California and Texas are really the big ones. They have the most people. That's where you're going to get the most seats. It looks like we're getting some other states trying to carve out one or two here and there. And now that the Democrats took over the legislature in Virginia last week, they're going to try to carve out another one or two seats for Democrats there.
So when it comes to the midterms and President Trump, how lame of a duck could he be? Or considering he doesn't really speak softly and carry a big stick, he speaks loudly and carries a big stick. How much could that affect what he does in his last 2 years or his agenda or what he's done in the previous 6 years, although there were some time in between?
Right. No president wants to have what we call his divided government, which is one or both of the chambers of Congress controlled by the other party. It means you have to compromise and you have to find ways to get the government funded, to do other things that Congress does by working together with the other side. You can't just push things through like they did with the big, beautiful bill back in July. So it makes things more difficult. It also opens up the aspect of the different powers that each chamber has. For example, the House, you know, can bring charges of impeachment. They can investigate. They have oversight. The Senate, of course, also has oversight. But the Senate is really, really powerful because they have to approve about 2,000 of the jobs that go into the executive branch, the people that Donald Trump appoints to his own administration, including those ambassadors and high-level cabinet members. And, of course, they also approve those judges who serve for life. So the Senate, if you had to ask me right now, I think it looks like the House might go Democratic, and it looks like the Republicans might retain the Senate just because the states that are up, because only one-third of them are up every 2 years in the Senate, are in much safer states for Republicans.
So with that being the case, what would that portend for government, for the people like us that just are trying to go to work and, you know, make a dollar here or there and go on vacation if we can? What does it mean with a Donald Trump as president, a Democratic House and a Republican Senate?
Yeah, it means you're going to get less big policy through the administration. There's a lot of political science scholarship that says that when you have divided government, it's not that you get less policy, but it becomes less left-leaning or left-right-wing. It's more compromised, meaning that if the president wants to do something kind of extreme, like quadrupling the number of border agents we have, a lot of funding like that, it's not going to be to the extent that he wants. So it sort of makes it more of a steady state, less big government action, which some people appreciate.
All right, let me take a break. We'll talk about this Epstein thing. When we come back, we're talking to our friend Todd Belt, who is a professor of public policy. I got it right here. A professor and director of the political management program at George Washington University. It is 6:20, time for traffic, WWL. 6:25, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Somebody texted in, you know, accusing me of Trump derangement syndrome because we're talking about these Epstein emails. Again, I would suggest that if every time the name Donald Trump is spoken, you react negatively, no matter what's being said, I would ask who really has the Trump derangement syndrome. But that being said, let's talk with our guest, Professor Todd Belt, a professor of director of the political management program at George Washington University. Here's where I am on this email. As I understand it, the victim, the emails that were released, I don't understand what's going on. Let me ask you factually what's going on, and then we'll get to the political part of this.
Sure, Tommy. I mean, this is what's a little bit difficult. The Democrats released these three emails from the that were between Ghislaine Maxwell and Epstein, and between Michael Wolff, the biographer, and Epstein. And I don't think it's any coincidence that they did it on the day that the Republicans were celebrating a victory in the shutdown fight, right? It's all politics, right? And subsequently, Republicans on the committee flooded the zone with the 20,000 emails that they released. The three that were released by the Democrats really give lie to the idea that Donald Trump did not know what was going on with Epstein. Now, Donald Trump said that when he found out about what Epstein was doing, what he said, what Donald Trump has said on the record about Epstein is that he stole one of his employees, which is someone who's working in the spa. And then when he found that out, he kicked him out of Mar-a-Lago. Turns out Epstein was never actually a member of Mar-a-Lago, but he was never allowed to return, and their relationship terminated after that, sometime in the teens, the 20-teens that happened. But there's information in here that Epstein says that the one really damning one says the dog that hasn't barked is Trump. And you can read this in a couple ways, either saying that Donald Trump has not talked about his relationship with Epstein, or that Epstein has this over Donald Trump, a pieces of information, compromising information on Donald Trump. And Epstein is saying, you know, this is something that, you know, hasn't happened yet. And Maxwell is replying, said, I've been thinking about that. So it also says that Donald Trump spent several hours at Epstein's house with a particular individual that was redacted by the Democrats. And then when the Republicans released theirs, they released the name, which was this Virginia, I forget her name. She's a woman who committed suicide a few years ago, who was the one who was part of this. So,
who said that the president didn't know anything about this, right? At one point she said that? She said that Donald Trump didn't know anything about this.
Correct.
He was not president.
So, she's the one that that was taken from, but I don't know that that's exactly the person they're referring to in the first email. And the second and third email are with Michael Wolff, and this is ahead of the debate after Donald Trump has announced that he is going to run in the Republican debates in late 2015, and they're talking about CNN plans to ask about Trump's relationship with Epstein. This is Michael Wolff sort of giving PR advice to Epstein. And Michael Wolff is this biographer who's, you know, somewhat problematic in some ways. And it seems like he's, you know, not doing the job of a journalist. He's actually trying to.
We only have 30 seconds here, Professor. Let me jump ahead and just ask you,
sure.
Are anybody's hands clean here, or should the Democrats and Republicans and the Justice Department and everybody else just release whatever they have and let the public make of it what they will?
Well, I think that's really where we're going with this. And this is public pressure, because it's probably not going to get through the Senate. And certainly Donald Trump would not sign a bill about releasing these files. So I think it's public pressure that everybody's trying to work on right now.
So somebody's trying to hide something somewhere, whether it's a Democrat, whether it's a Republican. Somebody doesn't want all of this to come to light, right?
Either one side is cherry picking, or the other side doesn't want anything at all to come to light. That seems seems to be the case.
Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time as always. Todd Belt, a professor and director of the Political Management Program at George Washington University. Taking a break, come back with Mike Strain here on WWL. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 6:44, 16 till 7. Beautiful day outside right now. It's 55 degrees, going up to 76, 75 tomorrow. Pretty much the same thing all the way through the weekend. Then a little bit warmer by early next week into the lower 80s, but dry all the way through next week. And then maybe a little bit cooler by next weekend. Mike Strain joins us now, Commissioner, Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Dr. Mike Strain from the North Shore. How you doing, Doc?
Man, I am doing great. Looks like the government shutdown is going to end. We had that vote late yesterday. The Senate voted late Sunday, then late yesterday. And so some good things there. There was a language in there to fund the USDA and the FDA for a year. And they also voted in, you know, and moved the language forward to continue the farm bill for a year. So that's good. This funding CR, though, lasts till January the 30th. So we're not finished with this yet. Mm-hmm. This is very temporary, and I think in January, probably the first part of January, this process is going to start over again. And so, you know, the pull and the tug and everything that's going on in Washington will continue. But the good news is that we're able to move forward with the USDA programs. So SNAP benefits, at least for now. And then, of course, all of the USDA programs are back into action. You know, if you look at the overall farm bill, you know, it was basically split into three separate pieces. You know, they passed most of the farm bill in the one big beautiful bill, OBBB, but a significant portion was left out. And then, of course, the SNAP was separated. And so that, which, again, was already, you know, over 2 years overdue, they've kept punting it forward. And so now we've got to pass a five-year farm bill and get that done and do it in a total package. And they've kicked that down the road for another year.
Let me talk about this hemp provision in this bill. Does that affect Louisiana farmers at all?
Well, it does. You know, we have a hemp program. It is small here. It is difficult to grow hemp here in Louisiana. But what it does, it prohibits the extraction of basically any of the psychoactive elements out of the hemp. So all of these hemp products with the Delta 8, Delta 9 that you see for sale, retail for sale, that is outlawed in this bill. And that is going to change the dynamics of a lot of things. So hemp basically will be able to be used industrial to make, you know, fiber and that sort of thing, but also only those directly products that is in the hemp itself. So you won't be able to concentrate, potentiate, use it for processing. A lot of hemp is sold for those purposes. And so, it will have an effect. It will not be a large effect on the farmers here, because most of the hemp that is grown is then sold, a lot of it into Oregon, et cetera, where they take and use it to blend in with the legal marijuana. So they grow the hemp, they send it there, they blend it in, and then they sell that final product because the legal marijuana in those states sells for a lot more than the hemp does. And so the hemp that is grown here, most of that goes for those purposes.
So nothing's going to change because they can still sell it to Oregon, even though marijuana is still a Schedule I drug federally. Some states have made it legal. Legally, people can still grow hemp here and ship it to Oregon where they can do whatever they want with it. Is that accurate?
That's correct. And okay. But the hemp still, under the law, has less than 0.3% THC. 30 days prior to harvest. I mean, so the same USDA rules apply. None of that changed. It's just that they can't take the hemp and then extract the Delta 8 and Delta 9, and they can't take the Delta 9 and turn it into Delta 8 and all those things they were doing with it, and then put those products into the convenience stores and everywhere else that it's being sold across America.
So, Mike, take me back to the crop level here with hemp and marijuana. I don't know what's what. Who's growing what where?
All right, so the difference is hemp is defined as cannabis and mostly sativa, but also there are other species that is grown under a USDA license agreement. So in other words, USDA has an agreement through the Department of Agriculture, our office, and that you have a legal license to grow the product. And then that product is grown and is tested prior to harvest. Tested prior to harvest and less than 0.3% THC, and then that is defined as hemp. Any of those same products that is not grown under that contract by legal definition is marijuana. Okay. And that's the way it's a legal definition as well as a physiological definition of what the product is.
Is the plant the same product, except for the THC content?
THC content and you have a license to grow it.
Okay. But the plant itself is the same.
It is the same except that the THC content is much lower. So it is a different a different variety of the same plant, yes.
I guess what I'm asking is, would I know, is it like a rose bush or a chrysanthemum? Would I know the difference to look whether it's hemp or marijuana?
Well, you really can't tell. I guess if you were very, very keen breeder, you could look at that and say, you know, this looks like hemp. But generally speaking, the plants look very much the same. They produce the buds and that sort of thing. There are some varieties of hemp that grow very, very tall, and there's a lot more fiber there involved. But still, for most people, you cannot tell the difference just looking at it.
Let me take a break. We'll get traffic in, then we'll pick it up, talk about Thanksgiving and more when we return. 650, Mike Strain's our guest. Traffic now, WWL. 657, 3 till 7. Couple of minutes left with Mike Strain, Commissioner of the Department of Louisiana Agriculture and Forestry. Mike, Thanksgiving's coming up, and if you've not yet begun to thaw your turkey, it's too late. You may as well wait till next year, right?
No, we still got a little time.
Okay.
Just a little bit of time, but we're not going to put it in the trunk, so we're not going to do that method.
No,
don't
do that.
But now's the time to go shopping for your turkey. They're running about $1.48 a pound. Some of the larger turkeys, the largest, are about 17 to 18 pounds, averages about 12. But if you look how long it takes 24 hours for every 4 to 5 pounds. So a 16-pound turkey will need 4 days to thaw in the refrigerator. If you put it in the refrigerator, put it in a tray. Don't just set it there, in the refrigerator. Because you have to be careful. You don't want any drips going on to other food products. So you have to handle that with care. Now, there is another way. There are other ways to do it, like in the microwave. You can do that. And you can also, there's the cold water method. And it takes about 30 minutes per pound in cold water. And you got to change water every 30 minutes. So that can take quite a while. Then you got to really, really clean that sink up. Clean up very, very nicely. And then again, there is a method for using, doing that in a microwave. But again, make sure you follow the instructions per pound and really only small turkeys. But you got to do it very safely. But, we do it, but you got to remember. And if you've forgotten, then you're going to have to do it by the cold water method and clean everything up. And then as you get ready to cook. And remember, it takes about 2 hours for an 8 to 12 pound turkey. 16, 2 to 2.5 hours. 16 to 20 is 3 hours. So again, and if you got that monster, that 20, 24, 3 to 3.5 hours, you got to get it to an internal temperature of 165 degrees to get that extra yummy turkey.
Mike, real quick, some final thoughts about cold weather.
Oh, it's nice, but now's the time to get prepared. Before it gets really cold, you go out there and make sure you've got everything in place. Don't wait until dark when it's ice cold to do your plants, your pets, and your pipes. But now is a good time to check everything out because we had a little snap. We've got a little reprieve. Now's the time to get everything ready. And right now, if you've got farm equipment, don't forget, check your antifreeze. Do it now. Be careful where you put that used antifreeze because it is toxic.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate your time. As always, Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. We'll talk some LSU football when we come back. Also, New Orleans Sewage and Water Board. Another beautiful fall morning here in the Crescent City. About 55 degrees if you average your temperatures, going up to 76 today. And it's going to be that way pretty much for tomorrow and Saturday and Sunday, maybe warming a little bit into Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. But then it cools off a little bit by next weekend, although they're not saying any real chance for showers, so pretty much dry till then. Good time to get the car or truck or whatever you got washed. Glenn Gobo joins us now, editor of Tiger Rag. Talk about Frank Wilson, LSU quarterback situation, and more. Good morning, Glenn. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Tell me about Tiger Rag before we run out of time.
We just started.
I know, but I just want to make sure I get you plug in. That's all. I'm trying to help, Glenn. Do a brother a favor here, will you?
TigerRag.com, free website. We've got a lot on the coaching search. Got a column on Lane Kiffin up right now, and basketball, all the football shenanigans on the website, and we'll continue with that until this crazy time at LSU finishes.
Shenanigans is a good word. Tell me what's on. What do you think is on Frank? If Frank Wilson was to make a list of things to do after the game on Saturday night, what do you think would be against Alabama? What do you think would be on his list? Top five things
after the game Saturday against Arkansas.
Yeah,
what he wants to do Saturday night.
No. After the game, what was on his list for this week?
Oh, I got you.
Yeah,
I got you. Yeah, well. It's the same list it's always been, which he kind of said after the game. You know, he's got to improve the running game, which he did a little bit. And I would say the offensive line, but that, you know, you can only be as good as what you have there. Mm-hmm. They need to stop the false start penalties. I mean, really, the team looked almost exactly the same as it did under Kelly last week.
I think that's a great observation because you know what? I was thinking the same thing as I sat there looking at it. I did.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, meet the new boss, same as the old boss is what I wrote about. And, you know, he's in a tough situation. You know, when Coach O took over in the middle of the 15 season, there was a lot of talent on that team. And he did a great job with it, but he had a lot more going for him at that point. I don't think Frank is in a situation where he can really improve the situation.
This offensive line situation is a bad one because it seems like a lot of times I'm seeing 3-5, and I don't know what you do about that, Glenn.
No. Really, as much talk as there has been about Brian Kelly, the real reason he didn't win enough at LSU because he was fired without cause because he didn't win enough, is because he didn't recruit high school talent well enough. Not a top 10 recruiter, not a top 5 recruiter. They just didn't have the same talent they had under Coach O and Les Miles, who were excellent recruiters, and then Saban, the best ever before that. And they were behind in the portal. They just started doing that this past year. So there's just not a lot of talent, not a lot of draftable talent in the LSU program, and that's rare.
So let's say, because last year certainly there was with the offensive line. Let's say Lane Kiffin comes in. What would he have to change? What would be the first thing? What are his strengths? What can he bring to the program, Glenn?
Well, the first thing he would need to bring is a quarterback, and he's really good at getting quarterbacks, particularly via the portal. Maybe he would bring one of his from Ole Miss. Mm-hmm. But, Nussmeier's a senior, and I really don't think Van Buren was ever seen as the prospective starter after Nussmeier leaves. So the next quarterback at LSU is not on the roster right now, so he needs to bring that in. And he would be the first true offensive coordinator ever to be LSU's head coach. That would be a step in the right direction because that's the movement now is offensive head coaches. And I would say just overall organization and effort and hunger. You know, I think Brian Kelly wasn't as hungry when he came to LSU as he was in previous jobs he had.
So Blake Baker would stay around, you think?
I don't know. I don't know. Blake's been up and down as LSU's defensive coordinator. Head coaches like to bring in their own guy. Lane has always hired a great staff, which was one of Kelly's problems and really Coach Orgeron's problems too. At the end, they didn't hire good staff, so Lane may want to bring in his own guy on defense.
So what do you think Frank Wilson should try to accomplish with the games that's left? What would be the best thing that he could do for LSU?
Well, you know, the best thing he did last Saturday was that the team did play hard. They played spirited. they look to have a little more energy than they had in recent games. So he needs to keep doing that, especially coming off a loss. And this is a winnable game more so than last week. It could be a really high-scoring game because it's two poor defenses. Mm-hmm. So he's just got to work on the spirit of the team and keep things going. But his most important job is you know, starting now and at the end of the season, keeping the roster together, not having a mass exodus to the portal, and keeping the recruiting class together. He's got an early signing period coming up the first week of December, and they probably won't have their head coach yet. So that's going to be really key for him until they do find a head coach. If that's Kiffin, it might not be till January. So Kiffin would need to keep Frank if he can keep the roster together.
Tell me about the timing of all of that. If it were to be Lane Kiffin, he would LSU could not approach him or could have.
DSW, birthplace of the humble brag. Here, the shoes are so good, no one would ever know how little you paid. If you didn't go telling everyone, that is. And with never-ending options for every style, mood, and occasion, all at really great prices, we'll definitely give you something to brag about. So go ahead, stock up on fresh sneakers from your favorite brands. Or try those boots you always secretly knew you could pull off. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Ark Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure game where most of humanity shelters underground. But Raiders rise to the surface in search of something greater. In the Rust Belt, danger isn't the end of the story. It's the beginning of the adventure. Every journey above ground is a gamble against the relentless machines of Ark and rival Raiders chasing the same dream. Explore a lethal yet vibrant world scarred by old conflicts and reclaimed by nature, where shifting conditions make every high-stakes run unpredictable. Ark Raiders. Available now on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X, S, and PC. Rated T for Teen.
At Marisa's, we're all about great jeans. You know, the ones that fit you just right. The ones that go from work days to weekends and everywhere in between. The ones that simply make you feel good. Because you don't just wear jeans, you live in them. With 25 sizes, 5 lengths, and 6 denim brands, you've got options. And fit experts in every store to make jean shopping easier. Find great jeans starting at $29.90 in stores and at Marisa's.com.
You open the fridge, there's nothing there. So what's it gonna be? Greasy pizza? Sad drive-thru burgers? Dish by Blue Apron is for nights like that. These are the pre-made meals of your dreams. At least 20 grams of protein, no artificial flavors or colors, no chopping, no cleanup, no guilt. Keep the flavor. Ditch the subscription. Get 20% off your first 2 orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Tell you what, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back about the timing of Lane Kiffin, if in fact LSU goes after him. We're talking with Glenn Gobo, editor of Tiger Rag 720, Traffic Now, WWL. Meet the old boss. Same new boss, same as the old boss. Glenn Gobo with the quote from The Who earlier, editor of Tiger Rag. Glenn, let's talk about the timing of LSU and approaching Lane Kiffin, when they can talk to him, when they can't talk to him, when he can announce something, when he can't. And that's all based on transfer portal, on recruiting, et cetera.
Well, that song reminds me of the Saints Super Bowl, right? They played that at halftime.
Did they?
The Who.
Yeah, they sure did. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yes, that was one better halftime shows I enjoyed, at least. Although I was a little bit too nervous to enjoy it, Glenn. Right?
And the Saints were figuring that onside kick, so I don't think they were enjoying it either.
No.
But they were working.
They were working.
Those
that's
are the
right.
Days, right?
Yes, sir.
No, the NFL has always been much more organized than college football, and they got clear rules about when you can talk to a coach who's an acting head coach who's in the playoffs. You know, that those rules don't exist in college football. So it's gentleman's agreement. There's no gentleman anymore in the game. So I think it's whatever LSU wants to do. You know, they may have already talked to Lane Kiffin's people. I mean, Jimmy Sexton is Lane's agent. Virg Ausberry has known Jimmy Sexton for a long time. So those things are going to be going on in secret. You know, maybe something would leak out at the end of the regular season. That's what I wrote about today. But if that would be real strange if they do hire Lane. I think it'd be a great hire. But he would want to. I know he would want to coach his team through the end because they're undefeated and they have as good a chance as anyone is winning the national championship. So you got to let him do that. And if it gets out that he's coming to LSU or going to Florida while he's still coaching the team, you know, that could get a little crazy. So it's going to be interesting to see how that all goes down.
Has Lane Kiffin said anything about this at all?
Well, you know, naturally he hasn't said anything specific, but it was very interesting. I wrote this is on the website this morning. At his press conference Monday, he was asked, what are your top priorities for a college head coaching job? He didn't mention LSU or Florida, but Lane started talking about big stadiums, which Ole Miss doesn't have, mm-hmm. national championships, which Ole Miss doesn't have, Heisman trophies, which Ole Miss doesn't have, and he said proximity to talent, which the state of Mississippi around Ole Miss does not nearly have like Louisiana has and Florida. So he was basically saying he wants a job like LSU or Florida. I think most people kind of think this is his last year at Ole Miss, so it's going to come down to LSU or Florida, I would think.
Would LSU be a long-term home for him?
Well, define long term. I would say, yeah, he'd be there.
Nick Saban at Alabama long term.
Yeah, that's a rarity that's happened. But Lane is 50. I mean, I could see him staying at LSU at least 5 years. I've always thought Lane would be a great head coach again in the NFL. I wanted the Saints to hire him when they hired Dennis Allen, mm-hmm. and when they hired the last coach. So if he would come to LSU and do well, I think the only chance of him leaving would be for an NFL head coaching job, but that would be years down the road.
Thank you, Glenn. I appreciate the time. Y'all can go to TigerRag.com, find a lot of commentary there. We're waiting for. I got that right, huh? Glenn?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I thought so. Okay, Glenn Gilbo,
commentary.
Editor of TigerRag.com. A lot of commentary there. You bet. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. We'll talk to Steve Nelson when we come back. General Superintendent of the Sewerage and Water Board. It's been dry, so you really don't think about the Sewerage and Water Board, what with no rain and so forth, but all we need is one rainstorm, and that'll get it back on our radar. So we'll talk about what's going on with the power plant, what else is going on with different power facilities and more when we return. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. Beautiful fall morning in a Crescent City and the surrounding areas. You average a temperature around the mid-50s or so, going up to 76 or so, and it's going to be that way for the rest of the week and into the weekend, warming next week. And then maybe a little bit cooler by next weekend, but no chance for showers, which is good news for the people at the Sewerage and Water Board, I would think. We welcome in Steve Nelson now, General Superintendent of the SNWB of New Orleans. How you doing, Steve?
Living the dream, Tommy. How are you?
I bet you are. Tell me about this dry weather. When it's like this, what do you guys use these opportunities to do?
Dry weather can be a blessing for us. When it's dry for too long, it can be a challenge on some of the infrastructure, because if you think about like the sponge on your sink, it's on the side of your sink. If it dries out for too long, it starts to shrink. And then the same thing happens with some of our soil, so we start having water main breaks at a rate higher than normal. But from a stormwater perspective, it's pretty easy to succeed when there's nothing to pump.
Got to pick your poison, huh?
That's it.
Tell me about Turbine 5.
Yeah, T5's back online. As of last week, we had an issue with some controls. They had to chase down a fault. They got that figured out, got it fixed. It's back on and available.
What's going on with the new power plant?
We have three frequency changers that are taking that 60 hertz power that Entergy provides, and then turning that into 25 hertz power. And the first of those three is undergoing a reliability phase test, which is essentially a test that has to be 30 days of flawless operation before we check the box on that test. That should be done here in December. And then the second frequency changer should be available for use here in November. So that will give us 44 megawatts, which is our peak demand capacity on these brand new pieces of equipment.
Tell me, if you can, while we're not worried about flooding conditions and so forth, for people that don't know, take me back through Sewerage and Water Board 101, if you will, and how the system is designed and maintained.
Yeah, so our drainage system starts at the gutters and the catch basins. The water flows through that to the canals, and then it's pumped through a series of pumps. We have 93 major drainage pumps throughout the city of New Orleans, about half of which run on a flavor of power that's a little different than what Entergy makes, and that goes back 100 years to when, you know, before electricity was standardized across the country. And so in order to power those pumps, we have historically for the last 100 years generated our own 25 hertz power. And so we're getting into a new scenario where we're not relying on things like Turbine 4, which is built in the very early 1900s, World War I era, and getting into a position where we're utilizing new equipment and utilizing power from Entergy with backup from brand new turbines.
Tell me turbines and good. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say, does that answer what you're looking for?
It does, but I think sometimes people, and I get a text here about they don't understand about turbines and pumps and what powers what and how and the kind of like what it takes to get the pumps going, et cetera.
Yeah, and the pumps themselves are typically very reliable. I know the age old concern is, well, why didn't you turn the pumps on? Well, it's very seldom an issue with the pumps themselves. What has historically been a chronic problem for us is the power supply. So getting the power to the pumps and having the power to run the pumps has been the weak link for us. And so this new power complex is going to replace, in particular, Turbine 4, and then eventually these electromotive diesels. So it's going to make things a lot simpler and a lot more modernized.
So a turbine is a generator, basically?
Yeah, that's correct. So we have turbines 4, 5, and 6 right now, and 4 is a steam-driven unit. The insides of it, the guts of it, basically look like a jet engine, even though it's World War I era.
How are you generating the steam?
So there's a big natural gas boiler at our Carrollton water plant. So, yeah, we take natural gas from Delta Utilities, boil water, create steam, run that through the turbine, and that generates 25 hertz electricity.
What number one is that, Steve? What turbine? What?
That's number 4.
Okay.
So then number 5 is circa early 1950s. That's a natural gas-fired unit. So that unit, we just get it spinning, start burning natural gas. That spins the turbine, and that makes 25 hertz power.
So it cuts out the steam part of it. You don't have to generate
steam first. That's right. You short-circuit the steam part of it.
This is valuable stuff. I don't think people understood this. Go ahead. Keep going. You're on a roll.
All right. Very well. Well, Turbine 6 was installed in the early 2010s. That was an Army Corps of Engineers project, and that's actually a jet engine. So it's a GE unit. It's taken a jet engine that burns. It can actually, oddly enough, burn natural gas or diesel. And that's, you know, spin the jet engine and that generates 60 hertz power, which you can then run through a frequency changer to make 25.
Okay. So now, go ahead.
We've also got other power assets if you're interested in hearing about those.
I do want to hear about those when we come back, all right? Because I think this is interesting, and we don't have time to talk about this when the streets are flooded, but we do now. So let's. 7:50, 10 till 9. You got any questions about the Sewerage and Water Board? I also want to ask about catch basin cleaning and all that stuff. 504-260-1870. I'll pass them along to Steve Nelson, General Superintendent of the Sewerage and Water Board of New Orleans. Seems to know what he's doing. He's a PE, and he should. Traffic now, WWL. 7:57, 3 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Steve Nelson, General Superintendent of the Surge and Water Board of New Orleans. We're going to get back to power assets in a second, Steve, but I did want to ask you about smart meters. Somebody texted in and said, what's the deal with smart meters, installation, the way they're working, et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, man, great question and a really good story. We've reached substantial completion on that. We've got over 90% of the 144,000 meters installed right now, and it's making a huge difference. Instead of having a read on your meter every other month, our customers are getting reads every single hour. And if you sign up, I'll plug our customer portal, which is free, and we're not doesn't cost anything, not selling your information. You can go to swbno.org and sign up for an online portal account where you can check your usage on the hour. You'll get automated alerts if you we detect a leak. So if water's running 24/7 for two straight days, you'll get an alert to go look for a leak. It saves you money on your bill. It's been a very, very successful program.
What about catch basin cleaning? Are you guys doing that now as opposed to Public Works? And does the budget mess affect you all at all?
We are doing catch basin cleaning, yeah, as of January of this year. So from 91 to January 2025, it was a responsibility of the Department of Public Works. Well, now it's Sewage and Water Board. And what we're finding is next to this power complex, getting away from generating power with, you know, horse and buggy era turbines, the single most important thing that I can do as an organization, that our team can do, is to clear the drainage on a block-by-block basis. We've pulled over 10 million pounds of debris out of the system so far this year. But, yeah, the budget piece is critical for us. We got to be able to continue to pay the contractors, staff up, and that's going to be a big focus for us.
So, like, in terms of percentage of catch basins cleaned a year, do you go through it? Because you never stop, right? I mean, as soon as you finish, time to go start where you ended.
No, the average / standard is about 20% a year, and we're at about 10% of the catch basins and 5% of the lateral line. So you got to clean the small pipes too. You can't just do the catch basin; you got to clean the pipes too. So we're not where I want to be, but I know that we're already having a positive effect. We got to continue to do that.
Thank you, Steve. We'll get back to the power next time you come on. If it doesn't get in the canal, you can't pump it out. That's why it's so important to clear those lines and the catch basins. We'll take a break, come back, talk to J.P. Morrell on WWL. Not just that, but J.P. Morrell as well. 8:13, Tommy Tucker, WWL, New Orleans City Council member J.P. Morrell joins us now. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Tommy. How are you?
Fresh from Baton Rouge, huh?
More or less. I came back in more kind of one piece, maybe missing a finger or two.
Do you guys all drive together in it?
We do. It's our pool, you know.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
So tell me about the meeting itself. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but it was in a way a formality, but in a way not. Who testified or who had to say what to whom about what?
Well, essentially, it was a great opportunity for the state and the city to work together. Mm-hmm. We spoke for several weeks around the RAND, the revenue anticipation notes, to try and deal with the budget crunch, the cash crunch, to make sure city employees are paid. And basically it was Mayor-elect Moreno, myself, and Budget Chair DeRusso, and we were there representing the council and the city to say, listen, we agree to several compromises to have the state have significant oversight to make sure that we are spending money in the correct way as we kind of climb our way out of this terrible fiscal shortfall and this budget uncertainty.
At any point, did the discussions go to what a new administration would look like?
No, not really. I mean, the main issue was making sure that the RAND funds go into an account established by the council, that the legislative auditor would have some oversight over, and that we would work together to make sure that those funds are being spent by the current administration in a way that is simply to do payroll and to deal with emergency issues and not to be kind of just thrown back into the till, because until we get a grasp on how deficit spending and overspending got to this point, we need to make sure above all else that employees are paid and that city services are not interrupted.
When it comes to the new budget, and I was just talking to Steve Nelson, the Surge and Water Board, where are you guys at on that, J.P. Morrell, on the hearings for the budget and what a new budget could look like?
The hearings were all last month, so we had hearings every day for almost a month throughout October on the budget. The challenge is that budget was based off the mayor's representations with her economists that we would have around $750 million revenue. The reality in the wake of this fiscal crisis is that it's more than likely we're going to have significantly less than that, as much as $100 million or more less than the 760. So the council is working with the mayor-elect to probably craft an entirely new budget, because you can't base a budget off of money you don't have. So we've begun that process. I mean, obviously, we have to repay the revenue anticipation notes pretty quickly, which is also going to contribute to having less money for next year, because we got to pay it back next year. So we will be going through that process. We'll take into account a lot of the testimony that happened last month, but it's triage now, because we would have loved to have had $750-$760 million in a budget, but when it's potentially $100 million or more less than that, some of the things that were on the collective wish lists of various organizations, some services that people have grown accustomed to that are not essential, they're going to have to not be continued for the time being.
Like,
for example, there are some challenges with a lot of our social programs. For example, we canceled the council fund for 2025, which was in the budget for 2025, because the money wasn't there. We're hoping that with some new revenue streams, like when the new mayor comes on board and finally gets on the right side of Wisner, looking at some efficiencies in the New Orleans Tourism and Culture Fund, and maybe looking at some ways that the council fund and tourism fund can work together, that we can reinstate those. But it's going to require a lot of creativity and a lot of putting the nose to the grindstone and looking at how we can reallocate resources to try and prop everything up. It's going to be a big, big, heavy lift.
You went to law school, so tell me what happens with Wisner and the new mayor and the legal action with the heirs. Where does all of that stand?
It's bizarre. The council has won every preliminary case regarding Wisner. We won the summary judgment to get Wisner. And what's interesting, Tommy, is the city won Wisner. We are entitled to 100% of the proceeds. The mayor is on the sides of the heirs appealing the current mayor to get less money. And
so what happens when the new mayor is elected to that case?
She will establish the city of New Orleans is no longer split between the mayor and the council. If the mayor and the council are aligned, and once the new mayor changes positions from the current mayor and we're all aligned against the heirs, the city currently controls over, with LSU, with Tulane, with the city's base, we will control more than half of the trust, and that will change the entire dynamics of how this litigation is going. It's really disappointing that the current mayor is actively fighting for the city to get less money.
So the case becomes moot as soon as the old mayor is gone?
It doesn't become moot. The heirs are still going to fight. But when you look at, for example...
You've already won, right? Summary judgment?
Yeah, but we're in appeals.
Okay. Right.
We're in appeals, but remember, if we control, the city collectively controls the majority of the stake in the trust, then how the lawsuit is funded, what the positions will be, that all changes. Right now, because the mayor's on the side of the heirs, the city, as in the mayor and her representative, with the heirs, controls the majority. When the new mayor joins with the council, we unanimously control the vast majority of the trust. So it's a total shift.
How much money are we talking about?
We're talking about maybe $9 to $10 million a year in revenue generated. Now that has to all be reevaluated, because those are based upon evaluations that are years old. You'd have to have a whole new assessment of the trust and revenue. It could be substantially higher because it hasn't been renegotiated in a very long time. I doubt it could be lower because Port Fouchon has not been inactive, but it could be more than that. But revenue streams, reoccurring money each year, are more precious than just cash, because revenue streams, you can base things off of that.
This is business, not personal, the question I'm about to ask you, and it is, you can only have one mayor at a time, and I just wonder, do we even have a mayor now? I've not heard or seen a lot from her. Is the council interacting with her at all?
The mayor-elect is interacting with her. The council's engagement with the mayor has not changed at the end of her term. Mm-hmm. We haven't had much engagement with her directly for the last 4 years. she has not endeavored to change that. So the mayor-elect is working with her team on transition. But personally, I haven't seen the mayor, but that's not abnormal. I haven't seen the mayor in 4 years. So.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up there. We come back. J.P. Morrell, our guest, New Orleans City Council member, 820 Traffic Now, WWL. 825 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to New Orleans City Council member J.P. Morrell about the meeting that happened yesterday, and they got the go-ahead to sell the bonds to make sure that people get paid this year for the rest of the year. Will everybody get paid for the rest of the year that is a city employee now, J.P.?
Yes, the city council has to meet literally, Tommy, every Wednesday at 9 a.m., with the auditor to approve payroll dispersions out of the account, but with the funding that we now have, everyone will get paid.
So let's talk about overtime and NOPD. I'm seeing a quote here from the mayor-elect saying, having discussions with the auditor and also our inspector general, there needs to be better controls of overtime with NOPD as well. Also a better look at potential abuse of overtime. I don't have a cent to waste. And so that's another piece that we'll be working through as well to ensure that not just NOPD, but every department has the right set of controls on overtime. I don't know how you go about working that out with the police chief, because the police chief said she's not going to endanger anybody, right? Tell me about where the city is on that.
The issue is it's not about endangering anybody. It's not about the general position that overtime is bad. Overtime is necessary because our department is depleted. The issue is, and the inspector, the local inspector general, Mr. Michelle, has already been on this, overtime that is valid overtime is essential and necessary, but the police department isn't even tracking who's getting overtime or why. One of the points that the legislative auditor brought up is that there are instances in which you have officers that are giving up shifts to work details, and then you have to take another officer who is already working and give them overtime. Well, if you limit, for example, how officers do details, you might need less overtime because the officer who's supposed to work a shift would work a shift instead of having somebody have to do it for them. So it's complicated, but the reality is that it is important that all of the overtime that...
DSW, birthplace of the humble brag. Here, the shoes are so good, no one would ever know how little you paid. If you didn't go telling everyone, that is. And with never-ending options for every style, mood, and occasion, all at really great prices, we'll definitely give you something to brag about. So go ahead, stock up on fresh sneakers from your favorite brands, or try those boots you always secretly knew you could pull off. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Ark Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure game where most of humanity shelters underground. But raiders rise to the surface in search of something greater. In the Rust Belt, danger isn't the end of the story. It's the beginning of the adventure. Every journey above ground is a gamble against the relentless machines of Ark and rival raiders chasing the same dream. Explore a lethal yet vibrant world scarred by old conflicts and reclaimed by nature, where shifting conditions make every high-stakes run unpredictable. Ark Raiders. Available now on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X, S, and PC. Rated T for teen.
At Maurice's, we're all about great jeans. You know, the ones that fit you just right. The ones that go from work days to weekends and everywhere in between. The ones that simply make you feel good. Because you don't just wear jeans, you live in them. With 25 sizes, 5 lengths, and 6 denim brands, you've got options. And fit experts in every store to make jean shopping easier. Find great jeans starting at $29.90 in stores and at Maurice's.com.
Why does every recipe I try need 18 ingredients, including a jar of something paste I'll never use again but will sit in my fridge for 9 months? I just want dinner in the oven, fast. That's why I love Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals. They send you fresh ingredients that are already chopped. All you do is put it all together and bake. That's it. No chopping, no weird leftovers, just delicious, easy-to-make meals. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
We're doing as necessary, and what is missing in the police department, and this is not, even the chief has not disputed it, is that no one's tracking overtime. If someone asks for it, they give it to them. And when you're in this much of a financial crunch, it all needs to be necessary, and someone has to own it. And even the chief and what she said thus far, she's saying it's necessary, but she's not saying they're tracking it. And every department, not just in OPD, EMS, fire, safety and permits, DPW, all overtime needs to be tracked, and supervisors need to sign off on it and say this overtime is actually necessary. What we've seen across the city is for the last 8 years, if someone goes, hey, I want overtime, they go, sure. Mm-hmm. And literally no one bothers to check a box saying this overtime is for X and it is necessary.
So what is city government likely to look like with the new mayor and the new budget and the new revenue projections? Are you talking about massive layoffs? Are you talking about people being cut back to working 3 days a week? And if they work 3 days a week and you pay them for the whole week, well, that makes no sense at all. So if you pay them for 3 days a week, then you're going to lose employees or people are going to be making less money. What is it likely to look like, JP?
Well, I mean, it's too early to say. Those are some very large kind of scary prospects. I'm not saying that all of them are off the table, but until we dig into what the budget for next year looks like, I couldn't tell you that. I mean, what I will tell you is there are a tremendous amount of employees we have in the city that were there based upon federal programs and federal money that is no longer available. And the current mayor was trying to carry a lot of people that were funded by federal money using our general fund. Well, if the federal money for your position went away, we can't afford to keep you, which is very different than a traditional civil service or the regular departmental employee. So, but by virtue of the federal money disappearing, which is almost $200 million, government will shrink, but it'll shrink with positions that were never really funded anyway.
Shrink in a way that the average person in New Orleans would realize or not? Because if they wouldn't realize it, then you'd wonder, well, why were they there, right?
Well, I mean, when you had federal money funding certain types of programs, Tommy, those are people you don't see doing things the federal government's paying for. Will it affect the everyday life of the people of the city of New Orleans? Absolutely. But the charge of the new mayor and the new council is, how do we prioritize the things that affect daily people, and how do we prioritize quality of life and services, and how do we go forward with less money? Because the reality is, no matter what we do, we can all agree we're going to have a lot less money.
Stay tuned. We'll have all the details as they unfold. Thank you, J.P. Morrell, New Orleans City Council member. It's 8:30, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. A minor technical issue, but we got it resolved, and we're now joined by Joe Garrity, CEO of Crescent Canada, to talk about the new law that was signed into, the new bill that was signed into law by President Trump and how it could affect the hemp industry. Morning, Joe. How are you?
I have been better.
Yeah, I bet you have. Tell me, first off, about your company.
Well, the new law changes basically makes it so that 95% of the products we sell are illegal. It is devastating to our employees, the vendors we work with, the retailers that sell our products, and those who have spent the better part of the last decade building this company into the number one THC drink in the country.
When does this go into effect?
Well, it's not going to, but for now it goes into effect in 12 months. The fight has just begun. This was snuck into a government reopening bill that had absolutely nothing to do with hemp. It was done this way because it's wildly unpopular politically to ban these products, and they didn't want to have this fight openly and with people actually giving input. Because in places like Texas that have tried to ban this recently, Republican passed bills in the House and Senate were vetoed by the governor due to overwhelming business interests lobbying to have it removed. This is not a small business anymore. The hemp market is a $30+ billion a year industry that employs over 100,000 people across the country. It's a lifeline for farmers. It's a lifeline for small business owners who are seeing declining alcohol sales in their stores. And we are ready for a fight, and we're not going to lose this thing.
Tell me how this interfaces with the state law that changed, Joe. I'm a little bit confused, Joe.
So federal law only has one restriction for Delta 9, and that's that it has to be below 0.3% on a dry weight basis. Products like our drinks don't get anywhere near that level. Mm-hmm. What Louisiana did a few years ago was remove the cap to 8 milligrams and then further to 5 milligrams per container. So we're still allowed to buy 5 milligram Crescent 9 drinks all over Louisiana. And we've had a lot of success with that just here. But we're in 20 states. We sell products that are higher potency. We sell products that are different in other states. When Louisiana tried to ban this product, the reason that it didn't work, despite the interests of some of the richest people in this state, some of the most powerful people in the state, is because people reached out to their representatives, their senators, and they told them how angry they were that they were considering taking away a product that they liked so much. And what that did is it actually created the grassroots support that we needed to block some of those powerful people in the state from doing what they wanted, which was taking away your freedoms to choose what you want to consume. So what we need to do is turn that power to the federal level now. And over the next 365 days, we're going to be doing that. I'm flying up to Washington on Wednesday to meet with Representative Morgan Griffin, who's a supporter of the hemp industry. We have a champion in the Senate with Rand Paul. We have a lot of public support behind us here, and I think people are just waking up to the reality that the rug was pulled on this industry, and it's going to devastate families and lives and freedoms.
This was kind of snuck into there, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's the only way you can get it through. Mitch McConnell knows how unpopular this is. Everyone who voted for it knows how unpopular this is. And we have bipartisan support for these products remaining legal. They just weren't able to do what they wanted to do through traditional political channels, so they snuck it into an appropriations bill, which is the opposite of how every single politician argues we should be legislating.
So are you concerned that this does go into effect? Are you convinced that it's going to be either repealed or another law passed to do away with it?
I'm as concerned as I can be. We have 65 employees who rely on this just in our company alone. There are countless other companies in the state of Louisiana that rely on these products, from retail stores to manufacturers to direct consumer sales. And it's, you know, if you talk to anybody who's consumed our products, they'll tell you that it's been a game changer for them in a lot of different ways. A lot of people are getting off of alcohol, and that's not the fault of anybody. That's just the reality of the life that we're living right now. People are trying to get away from the harmful effects of alcohol, myself not included. But for retailers and distributors, you know, some of the biggest in the country, this is a rare source of income from them. This is one of the few industries they're actually seeing growth as beer and alcohol sales continue to decline. It's unfathomable to me that they would try to pull the rug like this on so many Americans who've dedicated their lives and their time into building businesses and growing this and distributing these products. It's just an absolutely wild thing to occur during a time when, you know, everybody knows that people are struggling. And there aren't that many jobs out there right now. And the economy's tough and things are getting expensive. And to just take away one of the fastest growing industries in America is just unfathomable to me.
So tell me exactly what this does. Does it change what you can sell, or does it change what you can get to manufacture what you sell?
It changes everything. I mean, they're pretending that this keeps alive the CBD market. It doesn't even keep alive the non-intoxicating market. The law itself is structured in a way that makes it impossible to grow hemp and impossible to sell hemp for any reason, from consumable to industrial purposes. This is not a well-crafted bill. This is just a sledgehammer that's going to destroy the entire industry. What it does from the practical perspective is it changes the law from saying you can have up to 0.3% Delta 9, which is the intoxicating THC that's found in all cannabis, marijuana, hemp. And it drops that limit down to 0.4 milligrams per container. So our products in Louisiana contain 5 milligrams per container. In the aftermath of this, we can contain up to 0.4. It's
which means I would have to do the math for me, which means to get the same amount of, correct me if I'm wrong, THC that is in one can of your beverage, you would have to drink how many cans?
12.
Okay.
And our 50-milligram product, which we used to sell a lot of in Louisiana, is quite literally the best-selling THC beverage in America. Do the math on that one. You're drinking 125 cans to get the same effect as you are from one otherwise.
And that you can't sell anymore, correct?
We can sell it in almost every other state in the country.
Right, but not in Louisiana.
We can't sell it in Louisiana.
Right. It's crazy, I'm telling you. What do you think's behind all of this, in your opinion?
It's Mitch McConnell. He accidentally legalized weed, and the world and the country was thrilled. Everyone finally got what we've been fighting for 50, 60 years. And after 7 years of the law being in existence, after companies building and growing and hiring and investing in this country, the rug just gets pulled without even a proper debate about it. He knew what he was doing. He's been trying to do this for a while, and he found his political cover to come in from the shadows and tie this thing into a government shutdown bill that he knew people were not going to vote against on the Republican side. And he won. He's a true political operator. Can't stand the guy. Truly my least favorite person in the country right now, but you got to give him credit. I mean, he snuck this thing in there, and there's nobody with a backbone to stand up to actually stop it.
And he knows he's not running again.
Yeah, and there were too many important political issues that were being discussed on the federal level to have this thing get any daylight until it was too late. I mean, when you're talking about people getting SNAP benefits and the military being paid and food and beverage,
right.
Food safety, and yeah, it's just there were too many other points that mattered more to people.
Do you change?
And I get that.
Do you change anything, Joe, that you do now from a business standpoint, or do you just go to Washington and just keep business as usual until you see that you have to change anything?
I told my employees yesterday, we're status quo, we're growing, we're continuing to try to be the best company and the biggest company in the state. We're signing new distribution contracts, and we're going to have some of the most powerful alcohol distributors in the country on our side, some of the biggest retailers, Total Wine, Target, Circle K. Everybody has jumped into this category, and they're not getting out without a fight.
So the higher content beverage, you can still get in Mississippi and Texas and those places.
Yeah, and you know what? We signed a letter with a lot of the industry heading into this when we saw the writing on the wall, and we said, look, we are willing as an industry to drop down to a 5-milligram cap nationally. If that's where we can find common ground, and that's where we feel that the limit should be set, we are fine with that. We want to survive. We want to have an opportunity to keep growing.
Thank you, Joe.
Keep food on the tables for our family.
Appreciate your time. Quick break. Back in a flash. WWL. 9:25, quickly back to Deuce McAllister. Y'all all know who he is. Deuce, when it comes to, and I was kidding before, but I mean it sincerely, talk about the officiating in the NFL. You can. I don't think they'll fine you. But, man, it amazes me how you're on top of it, and these guys are taking like 15 minutes to figure it out.
Well, Tommy, I mean, I'll get maybe an email or call for talking about him. But, no, I will not get fined like some of the players and the coaches for criticizing. Look, I get it. It's a tough job. It's a tough job. And so I've always said, you know, and actually after the game, I knew a few of the officials. I know them personally.
Mm-hmm.
I know them personally after it, but I didn't know that they were calling the actual game. It is probably like any professional sport, and really any sport in general. I think we hurt ourselves with the amount of rules. I mean, because the field goal block rule is one that it's the right rule if you're going by the book, but it's also one that doesn't make sense. And, you know, from my opinion, my viewpoint, once the ball was blocked, we know that by the Saints. Once the ball ricocheted off of a Carolina player, that ball should have been dead. But it was like, I guess, I don't know if they felt like that was touching or complete control, whatever it may have been. But since it did go back towards our line of scrimmage or towards the line of scrimmage, we touched it. Cam touched it. He tried to scoop it and score. They recovered it. That made it their ball. So I get it. But that's a lot. That's a lot. And so if they can clean up and kind of make the rules a little bit tough or easier for interpretation, I think that's what people want. I mean, because nobody pays to see officials go out and throw flags and blow whistles. And, you know, you come to see the players. You come to see the players go out and perform. Now, you do need organization, and you do need them. They do play a critical role. But, you know, at the same time, you want to see players play, and it's a tough job, but, you know, it's one where you don't want every play to be stopped because of officiating.
Tell me about Alvin Kamara and what you saw out of him on Sunday, because he was so close to breaking one.
Yeah, I think for Alvin, you know, probably from some frustration. You know, he's not obviously going to say it just because that's the type of player he is, but he wants to show what he has. I mean, he wants to be able to go out there and compete. he wants to still show that he can play at a high level. And, you know, I know that we hadn't seen him enough or as far as with touches and to be able to get him in space and open field. And, you know, this year he's probably had to run more inside just because you lost Kendre and then you didn't get Taysom back. And so you can't just run him outside every play. You've had to run inside probably a little bit more than they wanted to. But, I mean, he's done his job. So now for him, it's getting to the point to say, hey, how can I help? What else can I do? And so I thought that he had a really good job. He was able to get to that second and third level. And like you said, you know, there was a play or two where he's close to breaking it all the way. And hopefully he does get a chance to do so, you know, a couple of times on the second half of the season.
What about Tyler Shuck now that he's got a game on tape? Is his job going to get a lot harder, especially after people got 2 weeks to look at it?
Yeah, you get 2 weeks to look at him. It's really four games. I mean, and so they'll still go back and look at some of the preseason game. And even when he came in against Tampa Bay and, you know, you look at that. I mean, but for Tyler, you know that the looks will change a little bit. How teams kind of play you will change a little bit. Now that defensive tackle, instead of maybe getting up the field as far, he's going to hang back because he know you will step up into the pocket and try to, like we talked about earlier, try to manipulate it in that manner. I mean, and so he's just got to take what the defense gives him. I mean, I know that sounds generic, but that's kind of the truth. You know, there was a couple passes in there that were tight window throws, and he took it. Now, you may not have converted as far as on third down, but, I mean, those are tight window throws. And if you have that much confidence, I mean, to be able to throw them, at some point some of those throws are going to break, and, you know, the defender won't be able to come up and make those tackles. I mean, but, you know, there will be adjustments. Atlanta will have some adjustments for him when we get to them next week.
Tell me what you think of offensive side first. Play the offensive line, because they have had some injuries, and I thought they played pretty well on Sunday.
Yeah, they played pretty well. I mean, you still don't like the two sacks. I mean, you want a clean game from that aspect of it, but I mean that'll hopefully get better as those guys continue to go out there. You did have three new starters playing, you know, from the center, left guard, and right tackle. So, you know, they've all played for you this year, but, you know, to play the complete game, that's what they had to do. And, you know, you want time. You want time and you want run lanes. And so you want those guys to be able to be comfortable. We'll see if you get Fuaga back as your right tackle this upcoming week, you know, but if you don't, you feel good about at least who you have and what you have. And now it's just going out and executing that game plan. I mean, and so you would love to have the original five that you felt like that you had going into camp, but you know you traded one of those guys. And so now it's giving a young quarterback and those weapons an opportunity to be able to hopefully to be successful.
What did you see or what was most impressive to you about Tyler on Sunday?
I thought the poise. I mean, you know, when you go back and look at it, not only just from college, but early in the year, I felt like pressure, and no quarterback likes pressure in his face. But I thought that pressure, he understood and knew exactly where the pressure was coming from. So he showed pretty good poise. I mean, there's one series in there where he's talking to Devin Neal that he sees the pressure on the backside. And I think Devin had a 1-2, so Devin had to check front side. And then if that's not coming, then he goes backside. And so your quarterback already saw it. He was telling him, hey, that guy over there is coming. And so you see the just from the eyes of the running back and how his head moves, he goes 1-2. He goes back there. He picks it up. And so just little things like that. I mean, if he can continue to do that, it's only going to get better for him.
Did you see anything from him on Sunday, or is it far too early to say, you know what, this could be the guy?
I need to see more. Okay. I mean, I need to see more games. I need to see how you react when things go bad. You know, when things are bad, how are you reacting? When I don't have my fastball, how am I reacting? You know, can I still manipulate the defenses? Can I still be able to get the ball to some secondary guys? And so, you know, can I distribute it to 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 different players? And so, you know, when I'm not having the best day and I need a drive, can I respond to that drive? And so that's what I need to see before you just swear off and say, oh, yeah, we've got our quarterback. Nah, you had one game.
Tell me about the play of Kool-Aid McKinstry.
Kool-Aid has played well. I mean, he's played well. I mean, teams have challenged him. I mean, there's been games where they went right back at him. And, you know, so for him to be able to respond, that's what he's going to have to do. Talk about a defensive back having to have a short memory. Well, guess what? You're going to have a short memory. You're going to see some of the best athletes in the world. And, you know, for most defensive backs, they play it running backwards. And so for him, he's going to have that short memory, be able to understand and know my keys, be able to make plays. You know, another young player that has gotten more and more time is Raleigh, your rookie from Louisville. And so, you know, at times teams have tried to pick on him. I mean, but he was going up against a first rounder, and I thought that, you know, he held his own. There was a play where they tried to go to Tet early in the game, and he did an outstanding job of just staying in phase and squeezing him to the sideline where it was an incompletion. It was a go ball. And so if you can continue to get that confidence and get snaps, then, I mean, that's all you want. You want to see improvement.
Let me ask you about the stuff that goes on the field when it comes to protection, because you got the center calling protections, right? You got running backs sometimes calling protections, and you got the quarterback as well. Tell me how all of that communication doesn't just wind up in everybody talking at one time.
Yeah, well, the point. There's always going to be a point, and you'll hear the center call Mike 51 or Mike 52 or whatever. But I mean, for any offense,
that means
the
middle linebacker. Tell me what that means.
Yes, he's calling out the middle linebacker. Okay. He is calling out the mic. And so, but for any defense, you know, we talked about three down or four down. The Saints primarily are three down defensive linemen. And so, you know, that could be a nose tackle or two tackles and two ends. But you also have two linebackers. And so for the Saints, what you have to do when you're playing against the Saints defense, you make one of those guys a down lineman. And so now it makes it easier to be able to count them. I mean, because if you see 2 points, then that means that guy, hey, he's a jack. You know, it depends on what the offense terminology is. He's a jack. He could be a rush guy, or he could be a guy that drops into coverage. Mm-hmm. But that tells the back as well as the tackle that, hey, he's a potential rusher. And now from the rules, how the offense is built, the quarterback can come in and say, hey, I don't want Mike to be 51. I want Mike to be 31. That's who I want you guys to go to. And then now that bumps everybody over. Everybody is on the same page from that standpoint, because the quarterback has overruled the center. And as a running back, depending on what type of protection it is, that allows me and tells me what my job is now. That allows you and tells you what exactly your job is. And so that's in man protection. Slide protection is a lot easier, but it also leaves you open for certain rushes. And so slide protection is everybody, the center may call out Mike 51, but we're all sliding to a gap. We're just sliding to a gap. So if a team overloads one side, now you may be short a man to pick up because we only slid one gap. Mm-hmm. You don't slide over three gaps. The only way you do that is if it's a quick throw and you kind of throw your body out there, because your job is to cover a gap and slide protection. And so there's rules. Every team has rule breakers. You know, you have some really, really smart quarterbacks and really smart backs that kind of talk. They talk there amongst themselves, not between everybody else, that, hey, if this guy comes, I want you to act like you're blocking him and then release. And so that's something that, hey, it better work, because if it does, you got to go over there and explain it to the quarterback or to the head coach and the OC why it didn't work. I mean, but it may be just something that you saw on film and you feel like that this is what they're going to do. And so, you know, it's a cat and mouse game. It's a truly cat and mouse game. And you've got the defensive guys over there on that side, Mike linebacker, who is normally the captain, and he's calling out defensive sets and checks and different things of that nature. So it's film study, but it's a cat and mouse game.
All of this happening, and I would challenge anybody listening to that just now to get on a gym floor in tennis shoes and shorts and just walk through all of that. Go ahead and walk through all of that. Don't worry about fast speed. Don't worry about hitting anybody. Don't worry about any of that. Just walk through everything that Deuce just said and try to make sense of all of that. But then you got the controlled chaos, or in some cases uncontrolled chaos, that's about to unfold with huge, giant, muscular people going after each other. Is that about accurate?
Yeah, that's the mental part of it. You haven't even played the game.
Right. That's just the mental part.
Snapped at all.
Right.
That's
the
just
ball, the ball has not been snapped at all. We're just playing the middle part. And so I want to know who can absorb that information and if I can give you multiple plays. And so if I can give you multiple plays, then I can give you answers to the test. But if you can't handle the general information, then I may not be able to put you out there as much, because now you can't pass the test. Mm-hmm. You can't pass the test. And guess what? A hesitation is you're beat. Because once that ball snap and you hesitate because you don't know what you're doing, you're beat. You're either going to, one, it's going to be an unsuccessful play, and two, you may get somebody hurt. And so that's why, from the mental aspect of it, how much can I give you? How much can you absorb? How much can we put into a game plan, game specific? How much can we put in, and my guys know exactly what they're doing?
The next day after the game, whenever you watch the tape, it's apparent who knew what they were doing and who didn't?
I don't even need to see the next day. I mean, okay. Because most teams now, from technology, they're watching film on the flight.
On the pad,
They're watching film on the bus ride to the airport.
I got you.
So I can look at it, because it's supposed to be from an offensive line. If we were bumping to 51 and we're sliding the line, if somebody doesn't step right, you know that they don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they step right and the line is sliding left, you know that's the bus. If we have man-to-man and a guy lunges one way and he goes the other way, then either he's picking up a blitz or he doesn't know what he's doing. He didn't know that that was his guy. And so you can tell. It may take you rewinding it twice, but if I can see your head turn a certain way, or I can see that, hey, that guy's uncovered. Somebody dropped the coverage, because these two guys, three guys, they're doing one thing. He's not doing that. And so that was the bus right there.
Man, I love talking X's and O's with you and trying to figure out what the hell is actually going on, because we think we know, but we don't. We don't have any idea. As you said, that's just the mental part of it. Forget the physical part. Everything we were talking about is just the mental part before that. Hey, Deuce, thank you, man. I hope you have a good Sunday off. Play some golf, will you?
I'm going to definitely try. The weather finally is acting up. I appreciate it. You guys be safe, and thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you, Deuce. We appreciate it. And we'll look for you tomorrow at Rouse's Market in Marrero on 6205 La Palco. He's got his Sharpie ready. He's not buying groceries, but he will autograph whatever you want. 940, 20 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:47, 13 till 10. One of my favorite things that happens at this time of year has been going on since 1907, and it is the Turkey Day race. And to me, it's the optimum way to spend Thanksgiving. And with that, we welcome in Benjamin Burke. Get Thanksgiving started, I should say. We welcome in Benjamin Burke, Executive Race Director, New Orleans Track Club. How you doing, Benjamin?
Very good, Tommy. Thanks for having me once again.
Tell me about the race that I'm talking about, the Turkey Day race. Tell me about the origins of this thing. Who started it?
Yeah, no, it's rich, rich history. So back in 1907, actually, Tag Gormley, which the stadium that you finished the race in, he started it. It's actually the fifth oldest race in the country, and just so happens that he started another race we produce and own is the Jackson Day race, which is in January. So that's the third oldest race in the country. So it's a really cool connection between the two, and I'm just honored to be a part of this event and to see it flourish.
It's 5-mile course, but you don't have to run it.
You don't. You can walk, skip, hop. it hits all the best parts of City Park, down Roosevelt Mall, you circle around NoMa, on Henry Thomas, you go past the softball fields in the dog park. So it hits all the great spots of the park, and it finishes right inside the stadium on the 50-yard line.
I love the communal aspect of it, how everybody is there together, working up a good appetite for Thanksgiving and then just enjoying a holiday, maybe with a group of people that you would not otherwise be with.
Totally, totally. Yeah, it's a huge family event. We have a kids run in the morning, starting at 8 a.m. and then with the five miler that starts at 8:30. But we're projecting over 3,500 this year, partly for the first time in decades we have actually finisher medals that came out really fantastic.
So really?
Everybody finished. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Awesome.
The first time since I've heard since the 90s, since they've had finisher medals. So It's a really good looking medal. We promote it as an historic medal for an historic race. So make sure those finishers, come get your medal.
Everybody that is against everybody gets a trophy has never participated in a race where they got a medal at the end. Am I right?
Yeah. I know.
It challenges your beliefs, Benjamin. It really does.
Exactly.
It's like, wait a minute. I didn't do anything, but I got a medal. Yeah, I'm going to get that. Yeah. And take it home. You damn right. Take it home. Tell me who
you
the race.
Correct.
Yeah. Tell me who it benefits, Benjamin. Please.
A large portion of it, mostly all of it, goes to Spina Bifida of Louisiana. Last year alone, we raised just under $40,000 for Spina Bifida, so that was awesome. They're a great organization. They come out and hold the finish line tape. So if you see them at the finish line, please give them, a shout. So they're a really great organization to work with.
I remember one year, man, I had to have been 30 years old maybe, and I'm just pushing for everything I can to finish strong at the 50-yard line. And a gentleman that had to be at that time 85 years old barely nudged me out and beat me in a sprint at the end, and then he came up to me and said, "Nice race." And I thought, wow. I just...
That's true. I mean, it happens.
What did I accomplish, really, But I still would get my medal. I'm still going to get my medal this year. Tell me how people, what time is the race on Thanksgiving Day?
The race starts, the 5 mile starts at 8:30, and the kids run starts at 8. The packet pickup pre-race starts at 6:30. But we also have two chances to come before the race to get your packet and your items too. The day before at City Park, and then on Tuesday at NOAC on Rampart Street.
But you don't get your medal till you finish.
Correct. We do have people that will call in. Can I get my medal? Like, no, you got to finish.
There you go. It's get at the 50-yard line like everybody else. Tell me where people go to get more information.
They can get more information at turkeydayrace.com.
I'll be out there, I guarantee you.
All the history. Awesome. Yes,
I won't miss it. Thank you, Benjamin.
Sir, thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Go to turkeydayrace.com. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.
ARK Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure game where most of humanity shelters underground. But Raiders rise to the surface in search of something greater. In the Rust Belt, danger isn't the end of the story. It's the beginning of the adventure. Every journey above ground is a gamble against the relentless machines of ARK and rival raiders chasing the same dream. Explore a lethal yet vibrant world scarred by old conflicts and reclaimed by nature, where shifting conditions make every high-stakes run unpredictable. ARK Raiders. Available now on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X, S, and PC. Rated T for teen.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Coming at you live from Auto Trader, here's New Car Energy.
They're searching inventory. You can make a budget for your wallet to help you succeed. It's smarter car shopping just
for
you.
Find your next ride at autotrader.com, powered by Auto Intelligence.
Having control over your healthcare is a relief. Yet so many Americans struggle to find that freedom at a price they can afford. That's why Christians across the country are turning to Redeem HealthShare Ministry. Choose your doctors, your hospitals, your treatments, all while keeping costs low. At Redeem, faith meets real affordability and the freedom to care your way. It's healthcare that lifts your spirit. Join the community today at RedeemHealthShare.org.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on the team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.